And good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon, USA. My name's Andrew Geller, and got a solid hour about some very important constitutional law issues that I hope you'd want to be aware of. The first half of the hour, I'll be speaking with Jennifer Van Bergen about the concept of the unitary executive, a phrase many of you may have heard, like me, for the first time during the Senate Judiciary hearings regarding Samuel Alito's potential confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then in the second half of the hour, I'll be speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman regarding impeachment as a general concept and a necessary action in the near future. So the unitary executive has been written about a whole lot in the course of the past month. And my guest, in the first part here, Jennifer Van Bergen, wrote for findlaw.com on January 9th an article called "The Unitary Executive. Is the doctrine behind the Bush presidency consistent with a democratic state?" Jennifer is a journalist with a law degree. She's author of The Twilight of Democracy, The Bush Plan for America, which came out on Common Courage Press 2004. And she frequently writes about civil liberties, human rights, and international law. And welcome to the program, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, there has been much said regarding the unitary executive, or sometimes referred to as unitary government or governance. And this is an extraordinarily complex legal issue that I have found many constitutional scholars themselves to sort of not really be all that clear about what it is, if it's actually legal, etc., etc. So let's just start out with what you understand to be the origin of this concept of the unitary executive.
Well, the origin of it goes back to the founding of the Republic, when there was a discussion in the Constitutional Convention about whether the executive branch should be plural or unitary, whether it should be a body or whether it should be a single person who in the person of the president. And they decided they wanted it to be a president. They were dividing power, you know, into the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary branches, and so they considered that to be a sufficient division of power, but they felt that there should be a single person who was authorized to act in limited ways. So that's where the doctrine comes from. But the way it is used now by this president is vastly different than what the initial meaning of it was.
Well, let's actually kind of gradually work our way there. We'll definitely spend a chunk of time, but I want to lay more context for at least what the administration says is its rightful claim in terms of its power. Now, as you rightly mentioned, Alexander Hamilton wrote a bunch about the concept of the unitary executive. And that's really where the arguments that the Bush administration and other administrations, this is not strictly limited to the Bush administration, though they are the first to explicitly use this term in their argument. So there's a couple of different concepts here. There's the issue of departmentalism, and then there's a couple of constitutional claims for the basis of this power in the oath and take care clauses of Article 2 regarding the what the president is supposed to do while in office. Can you talk a little bit about the concept of departmentalism and then those two constitutional clauses?
Well, the concept of departmentalism is, my understanding of it is simply that each department, each branch of the government has their own unique authorities. And this kind of gets stretched into, with the unitary executive, that it's also called coordinate construction, which I don't know if it makes much difference what you call it. But the idea that each branch has the authority to, I mean, what it comes down to is the authority to determine what the law is. That I'm kind of jumping the gun on that because I had wanted to explain that the unitary executive has three different components.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was actually going to get there afterward, but if you want to do it first, go for it.
Yeah, the first two components of it are relatively uncontroversial. There has been some controversy in the past over specific, issues, but the first one is the authority of the president to appoint or remove officers of the executive branch, and that's relatively uncontroversial. And the second one is the president's authority to administer the executive branch. But the third one is the one that is coming into view and into controversy now, which kind of ties back to the departmentalism, is whether the president has the authority to decide what is and what is not the law. Now, I do want to say that the president, because he is the executive, he is the one who is mandated to enforce the laws. In order to enforce the laws, he has to be able to decide what the law is to the extent, that he decides whether to bring charges or not and so forth, in the Department of Justice as well as in many other ways. But to say that the president has the final say on what the law is, it really flies in the face of what we've come to call judicial supremacy, which is that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of what the law is.
Right, and that was something that the Supreme Court affirmed very early on in this republic, Marbury versus Madison in 1803. Everyone probably remembers the name of the legal citation, but may not remember what the case was about. And yeah, a few years into the republic, the Supreme Court, in my concept, just reaffirms what the Constitution says in that the judiciary is the one that has the final say on how laws are to be interpreted.
Yeah. And in a sense, it makes a lot of sense because the court is there deciding cases, that the case comes to them and they have to decide what the law is. And if it's the Supreme Court, they're the last place where a case can be decided. They have to be the ones that have the final say. If it's the president that has the final say, then he can simply ignore what either the legislative or the judicial branches say. And in that case, is there really a system of checks and balances?
Well, and that's something that we've seen with increasing frequency in this and, as I reference, prior administrations, but the administrations of George W. Bush have really taken this concept and run with it and are even seeming to try and expand what this kind of vague definition is to begin with. Do you want to address the oath and take care clause, or is that little too technical?
Well, I'd like to address? Uh-huh. I'd like to address how what you just said, how the president is doing this. It's a very interesting thing, the signing statements, and the fact that Samuel Alito was really one of the first people to propose using the signing statements to expand presidential power back in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a signing statement by the president is a statement that is issued upon his signing of a law. And previously, the various administrations did use signing statements at different times, all the way back at least to Madison, I think, or Monroe, to occasionally say, I'm signing the law, but there are things I don't agree with about it. But it's been very rare. I think, if I recall the numbers, it was something like 73 times the signing statements were used between Madison and, somewhere in the mid-80s or 70s.
Right, so almost a couple hundred years.
Yeah, and since then, since I think the Reagan administration up through this president, it was 322 times. And this administration in the first term alone, depending on whose estimate you take, is somewhere between 400 and 500 times that signing statements have been used to make objections to laws. So to go back a little bit, this president has used signing statements to say, I will interpret this law that I'm signing consistent with my authority as the president, and he often will cite his authority as the commander-in-chief, mm-hmm. and consistent with the unitary executive, which, of course, you know, unless you know what they mean by that, seems to mean nothing. And the most recent one he also issued consistent with the constitutional limitations on the courts, which is also a very interesting statement, because what does that mean? Does that mean he can simply ignore the courts? You know, he's signing the McCain Amendment, the anti-torture amendment. He signed this, and that's what, in part, raised this controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Because he signed it, but then he basically seemed to give himself a loophole to say, well, I can ignore it if I want to. And that was where he also said consistent with the constitutional limitations on the courts.
And, so, that has to do more specifically with his role as commander-in-chief, because the context in which torture would theoretically be taking place is, it's more likely to be in a military context as opposed to a straight civilian, although that couldn't necessarily be ruled out.
Yeah, well, that's another huge issue. First of all, the commander-in-chief powers were given to the president by the founders because they didn't want the commander-in-chief authority to be housed in the military, because they were concerned about military takeovers. So it's kind of interesting, because this president is asserting commander-in-chief authority to basically do whatever he wants, even in a civil context. You know, the supposed war on terror, now the question of that is whether you can have a war on an idea.
Or a tactic.
Yeah, and then, you know, the belief in this, the whole thing with the domestic, you know, the NSA warrantless surveillance that he authorized, the question of whether he was authorized by the authorization to use military force, whether that authorizes him as commander-in-chief to spy domestically. So where is the line between these two? When are you talking about torturing in war? Can they torture Hamdi and Padilla? You know, they're American citizens, and Padilla was taken into custody in the United States, and no criminal charges were ever brought against him, and he was detained indefinitely without being allowed to see legal counsel. Can you torture in that situation? And then if that's the case, well, can you go and get Padilla's children and torture them as well? You know, it really raises a lot of very troubling questions.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guest this morning for the first half hour is Jennifer Van Bergen. She's a journalist, has a law degree, and writes frequently about civil liberties, human rights, and international law. We're discussing the unitary executive theory of governance, and she wrote a recent article at findlaw.com January 9th regarding this issue. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has some more information about this, but not as much as it will have by later on Wednesday. So you can go to kboo.fm, go to the schedule, click People Rise Up, and you'll see a whole bunch of links related to this, as well as the issue of impeachment we'll be tackling in the second half of the show. Now, yesterday, two days ago, Monday, January 23rd, George W. Bush defended the National Security Agency spying program, utilizing the concept expressed in the authorization for the use of military force following the September 11th attacks. And he said, quote, "Congress gave me the authority to use necessary force to protect the American people, but it didn't prescribe the tactics." Now, that is a true statement. I will completely agree with him on that, because the wording of that resolution or legislation, I should say, is extremely broad. And basically it says all necessary. And I'm curious if, just as a slight side, do you feel as though the way some legislation is coming out of Congress, also controlled by the same party the president represents, do you feel as though Congress is letting legislation out that is weakening its own hand?
That's an interesting question. I do think so. I think And recently, I don't know who it was, one of the senators said something about how the congressional oversight now is just almost non-existent. They've completely weakened their own hands. I think that the authorization to use military force to allow domestic spying by the National Security Agency is such a huge stretch. You know, the Congressional Research Service came out with a detailed paper on this, and then the Department of Justice responded with their own white paper on it. I don't know if this is going to make it to court or not, but I think it's a huge stretch.
Now, one person who has written extensively on the topic of the unitary executive, presidential power, etc., is Christopher Kelly. And he writes actually in his dissertation, I guess this is, that there are two forces that manage to solidify the need for unified control by the president. The first was the rise in attention given to the vast administrative state. And the second was that the effect that Watergate had on the governing system. And he contends that it's really the last 30 years where this concept has kind of bloomed, for lack of a better metaphor, although very strong supporters can go back and say, oh, well, George Washington meant unitary executive when he spoke of this other thing. And, you can find concepts similar to this, and that would support it in historical writings. But it's really the last 30 years where it came to be sort of a concentrated, focused effort. And it was Nixon who really seized control of the administrative bureaucracy of the executive. And he writes that there were four specific ways in which he did that, and I won't get into them. People can read his dissertation. But he notes that there was a Office of Legal Counsel opinion from the Department of Justice. Many people are familiar with it in the sense that that's where a lot of these memoranda have been coming from, justifying a lot of Bush administration actions that has its legality questioned. But during the Clinton administration, the Office of Legal Counsel wrote an opinion regarding the significance of the signing statement. Walter Dellinger, then the Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, advised President Clinton's White House counsel that the president was obligated to use a signing statement in which legislation appears constitutional on the surface, but that parts of it would be unconstitutional if executed. And Dellinger continued that a signing statement, quote, that challenges what the president determines to be an unconstitutional encroachment on his power or that announces the president's unwillingness to enforce such a provision can be a valid and reasonable exercise of presidential authority. So, again, this is not an exactly brand new thing, but the Bush administration has really taken this concept and run with it.
Can I jump in here
Please.
And make a comment? I think the difference, I'm glad you brought the Dellinger paper up. It's a very interesting paper to read. I think the difference is that the presidents like Clinton worked with Congress, and of course Clinton had a Congress which was not his party. And compromised and negotiated and worked through issues. And this president is not doing that. It has a completely complacent Congress. So the balance of power here is shifting dangerously. And as you said earlier, Congress is allowing it to happen. Now we have the danger also that this may happen on the Supreme Court, too.
So what I'm curious about is with the lack of interest in Congress, as it appears to me, to really address this question amongst the ruling party in Congress. You know, the Republicans are very unlikely to bring the issue up of abuse of power of a Republican occupying the White House. So at this point, and I hate to offer this as the only suggestion, is it really just switching the party in control of the legislative branch? How does one back away?
You mean what's the solution to this?
Yeah, maybe not the solution, but something in that direction.
Yeah, what is a solution? That's a huge question.
Mm-hmm.
you know, there's so many different ways this could play out. I mean, if you look at history, you know, many people who are very alarmed will compare what's going on now to what happened in Nazi Germany with during the rise of the Nazis. You know, there's also comparisons that could be and have been made to the fall of the Roman Republic and the rise of the Roman Empire. I mean, we think that democracy, you know, American democracy is unimpeachable, as it were, you know, that it cannot be destroyed. But I consider this, what President Bush is doing, it is precipitating a constitutional crisis of a great order of magnitude. I don't think this is something that is, I mean, it would be nice if it could just be resolved by a Supreme Court decision, but I'm not really sure that that would be able to resolve it. He's going down a road which is very, very hard for this country to turn around and back out of. It's creating precedents, and it's creating a lot of, you know, when you don't have a system where there's, you know, there's opportunity for speech or opportunity for appeal or opportunity for oversight, it's like you know, a volcano with a plug in it. There's if you don't allow for healthy expression and dissent and ways of discussing things and working on things, you know, it's going to explode eventually, and that's very worrisome.
You incorporate in your article the unitary executive is the doctrine behind the Bush presidency consistent with a democratic state, something that James Madison wrote in Federalist Paper Number 47, quote, accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny.
Yeah.
Now, it's really kind of a curious situation because Congress has no enforcement authority whatsoever, but they do control the money. The courts get to declare finally and ultimately what law is, but they can't make the executive do anything about it, and they don't really have a way to censure the executive. That's only Congress. But if Congress is controlled by the same party and is unwilling to do anything, it really, you know, it's like, it's sort of like things come to a standstill in a sense. Maybe that's not the right metaphor.
Yeah, well, I think that this is, yes, it could very well come to a standstill in a certain respect and stay this way. And, you know, in some respects, the president does need to have authority to act, but what has happened is, over the past 30 years or so, there's been more and more pressure on presidents to act quickly, and this causes presidents to want to have more authority. This is written about by Harold Coe in his book, The National Security Constitution, which I highly recommend to people to read. I think that, you know, the situation that we're existing in, it can't remain at a standstill forever. Something is going to give at some point.
Okay, so in the last couple of minutes here, any suggestions on how people can help encourage this sort of release of the tension in the system?
Yeah, and in fact, I'm glad you asked that question because I wanted to mention that in my book, The Twilight of Democracy, I did not know about the unitary executive doctrine when I wrote the book, which came out, a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked to write about the Patriot Act, actually, and I ended up writing about a lot more. But in the first half of the book, I write kind of a constitutional primer. In the second half of the book, I talk about what the Bush administration is doing and how it is violating the Constitution, separation of powers, due process, and all of these constitutional concepts. And one of the things that I say in the book is that democracy is about people talking to each other and sharing their opinions and sharing information. Now, this may seem a very weak solution, but it is the fundamentals of democracy. that we keep talking and keep getting educated and keep informing each other and sharing our thoughts about things. So I would tell people, please get informed, get educated, learn about it. I'm so glad you're doing this on your show because, you know, people think they cannot learn about constitutional law, that it's way above their heads, but it is not. And people need to learn about it so that they can make these decisions, take them to the polls, write to their senators, whatever they decide that they need to do, but keep speaking out.
Well, and remember, when the U.S. Constitution was written, it was written so that, you know, basically uneducated in the sense that we understand it today, farmers primarily could read it and understand it and decide whether or not they would lend their support to it.
That's right. I even quote a farmer in my book who talks about why he decided the Constitution was okay.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why every citizen in this country cannot learn these basic things and understand them and decide what really, really matters. These things are important.
I've been speaking with Jennifer Van Bergen, journalist, possesses a law degree, author of The Twilight of Democracy, and an article, or two actually, about the Unitary Executive at findlaw.com. And you can find out more about her and writings about the Unitary Executive theory at the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. Thank you very much for being on the program to talk about this morning, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for having me. Again, it's been a great pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you.